Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Welcome again, friends, on this rainy day. There has been a lot of rain this summer. Sometimes when there has been day after day after day of clouds and rain, when the warnings for floods roll in one after the other, it can become easy to get a little discouraged. It can be easy to forget all the ways that rain is actually vital for our survival, for the Earth's survival. And to remember that there are places starved for rain, deserts that persevere through the driest days. It can be hard to remember that the rain will clear, but indeed it will. These storms have offered a strange opportunity for my family. It turns out my kids love to watch lightning. I did not love that when I was little. So we've been turning out the lights and opening up the blinds and watching the streaks just whip down through the sky. And there's this sense of awe and excitement tinged a little bit with fear, especially for the little ones. And I have strangely found a measure of hope in their love for this display of natural majesty. I realize that may sound a little odd, but for me, watching them watch the lightning, watching them feel safe and sound inside and appreciative of the wonder of life and this earth, watching them delight in what is in this moment, but also hearing them repeat back the reminder that the rain will stop eventually, it gives me hope for the cycles of rain and sun. It reminds me of the power and possibility held within all existence, the capacity we humans have to cultivate appreciation and awe and resilience. As we gather, we are mindful of the ways that our bodies and hearts and minds cycle with the weather, the seasons, the earth itself, and we commit ourselves to hope born from the knowledge of our own power and born from the inevitable truth that all things change with time. Welcome to this place of awe, appreciation, and hope. Each Sunday that we gather together here as part of our shared experience on a Sunday morning, we make special time for quiet. For some of us, this means a focus on breathing and on our presence in this moment. It means meditation. For others of us, it means a form of prayer, speaking the silent words of our hearts. And for still others, it means holding a space for gratitude for all that sustains us in our lives. However you use this time, I invite you now to sink into it with me, to settle your feet onto the floor, to put down anything you're holding, to try and relax your body as much as you can. Release the tension wherever you find it. And breathe in deeply and slowly. Our world moves very fast. Our news cycles are constant. A sense of worry can come to permeate our beings. Deep breathing, a chance to stop, can help ease that anxiety. So be still and breathe deeply as we move into a time of silence together. Feel the power of the quiet, the strength in sitting side by side with others who dream and hope for a better world. May you know that even in solitary moments, even in moments of quiet or of loneliness, you are not alone. You are part of a great company of hopeful, persistent, stubborn people who believe in something better. May that deep knowledge that you are not alone go with you every moment, every hour. So may it be. Almost 8 years ago, I was lucky enough to spend nearly 2 weeks in Israel. I went to attend a conference, but extended my trip so that a friend and I could tour around. Israel's a fascinating place for very many different reasons. It's a land called holy by three major religious traditions of the world. It's an area historically rife with violence and danger. It's defined in some sense by the mainly highly polemical and debatable political positions that abound within the country and that exist concerning the country the world over. My travels that November many years ago were prompted largely by academic concerns. Though I didn't enter graduate school planning to work on anything related to Israel, Jerusalem came to figure centrally in my work. I had thought for sure I would focus on Italian Franciscans and Dominicans and how their vows and lives were reflected in their art and architecture. Instead, the focus of my work became European pilgrimage to the Holy Land, specifically how pilgrimage did or did not relate to the late medieval, early modern development of the ritual of the Stations of the Cross, the commemorative practice that marks 14 moments along Christ's walk to Calvary and his crucifixion. Over the years, as I've described my doctoral work to folks, the eyebrows have almost invariably gone up. What possessed a born and bred Unitarian Universalist to spend years focusing on this Catholic ritual, on pilgrimage, and on a city that is, at least institutionally, pretty irrelevant to Unitarian Universalism? As my last name might suggest, on my father's side, I come from a long line of Italian Catholics. I've always found religious art and architecture fascinating, any religion, all over the world, but particularly medieval Christian work has been of interest and was a gateway to the topic I eventually landed on for my dissertation. And I have come to think that my affinity for that time and that art was largely a product of wanting to feel closer to my father's family, who we never saw. And so when I embarked on that trip to Jerusalem, between the work I was doing with European Christian texts, my own sense of my Christian familial ties and this desire to connect in some way, I assumed that I would find the Christian sites the most compelling, and I was prepared for a reaction of fascination and longing and wonder at the architecture and relics related to Jesus's life. Yet what I found during our trip was that instead, I was far more moved by the Jewish sites. Without question, the power of the simple church at Tabgha, with its light spilling through windows onto mosaics that commemorate the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes, affected me strongly. And I certainly found the landscape around the Galilee beautiful. But my heart was stirred less by the Holy Sepulchre and the church at Bethlehem, and more by the Western Wall, the Holocaust Museum, and the hilltop fortress of Masada. This thwarting of my expectations may be explained by the fact that I do also have Jewish ancestry, and the reality is that my theology is much more consistent with that side of my inheritance. I don't know for sure, but what I do know, from having spent years reading endless texts about travels to the Holy Land, is that my experience wasn't unique. Which is to say, many travel writers record experiencing something completely other than what they anticipated. And I think this is part of the power of the place. It has so many meanings for so many different people, so many layers to its own history and story, that it will never be exactly what one imagines when one sets out. This morning's reading came from a 7-volume work, alternately known as The Wars of the Jews or The Jewish War, by the first century historian Josephus. The reading describes the site of Masada. After this description, Josephus goes on to relate the story of a famous siege, providing, though, the only extant copy, or account rather, of this particular battle. In the first century BCE, Josephus tells us, Herod the Great had fortified a hilltop called Masada in case he needed to hide out in the event of a war. He built palaces and an armory, a system of storerooms that were developed to provide enough food and water for a large Roman garrison for months in case of a siege. But by the time of the story Josephus tells us, about 100 years later, the site was occupied by a small enough garrison of Romans that when the Jews were at war with Rome, a group of Jewish rebels, called by Josephus the Sicarii, could overtake the Romans stationed there and set up camp. To reach Masada with my friend that November, we traveled out of the bustling and crowded city of Jerusalem, east until we hit a road that ran south along the edge of the Dead Sea. All around is the Judean desert, dusty brown with hints of red, not entirely unlike the American Southwest. Cliffs and plateaus rise out of the desert earth like strange eruptions. The area is relatively small and has few people living in it, and when you travel through, there's little to look at aside from the landscape itself. There's the occasional tiny shanty town with lean-tos made of salvaged tin and fabric. As you travel alongside the Dead Sea, you can see evidence of the sinkholes that are part of what make this area so treacherous. Any deviation from the road can result in a vehicle running over unstable ground and sinking into salty earth along the coast. And as our reading described, out of this empty, almost lifeless area, on one of the plateaus that rises up is the site of Masada. 1,300 feet above the ground, Masada juts out a rhomboid piece of land. And there are two ways to reach the top still to this day. For the intrepid walker, there exists still that serpent trail mentioned in our reading, a steep and winding dirt trail that for millennia has led up to Herod's fortress. And actually, that's how my mother reached the top when she traveled there decades ago. For the more leisurely inclined among us, there's now an aerial tramway that can take you up to the top. And when you reach the top of this plateau, the space opens up in a way that's pretty hard to describe. What from below looks like any other desert topographical element becomes suddenly this whole settlement covered in ruins. The day I was there, the views of the Judean desert and the Dead Sea were striking, not in their clarity, but because they were so muddy. The air in every direction was just thick with dust and heat. It was on the guided tour that we took that I heard the story of Masada for the first time, actually. After wandering the top of the plateau in the heat of the Middle Eastern sun, we stopped in the ruins of a room that some archaeologists identify as the site of the synagogue during the Jewish occupation. The shattered walls and ledges that perhaps once served as seating for religious services provided little relief from the heat. And there were so many of us that I stayed standing, leaning against the wall in the doorway of a millennia-old structure. I pushed my sunglasses on top of my head, and I listened as our guide told the story. The rebels, he said, had overtaken the garrison after Jerusalem had been destroyed and burned in the year 70. Fleeing Roman persecution, other Jews had joined this initial rebel group until there were nearly 1,000 people living on Masada. Eventually, inevitably, the Roman legion arrived and began a siege. The Romans erected a ramp of rubble up the side of the plateau, which can still be seen today. Finally, after enough days, they had created a path sufficient to launch an attack on the stronghold. They employed battering rams against the exterior wall, forcing the rebel forces to build another wall within. Determined to gain entry, the Romans launched burning torches at the new interior wall that had been erected largely out of wood. The wall burned successfully, causing joy among the Romans, who decided that the next day would be the day they entered Masada. And yet, Josephus tells history that though the Romans arrived and took the site, they were unable to get their desired revenge on these rebellious Jews because when they entered Herod's former palaces, everything was silent. There was no resistance, no noise, no life. According to the story, two women and five children survived hiding in the grain stores. and they lived to tell the tale that while the walls were burning, the adult males among the rebels had met in the synagogue, supposedly the very room that we were standing in, and they had agreed, at the urging of their leader, Eleazar, that they would rather die than be slaves to the Romans. Eleazar, in passionate speeches quoted by Josephus, argued to his men that God was clearly not going to come save them, as he had saved the Jews at the Red Sea, and so better God should punish them for the sin of murder and suicide, than that they should allow the army the satisfaction of killing them, abusing their women, and enslaving their children. And so the plan was, each man was to go home, kill his family, and then meet back again at the synagogue, where 10 men would be chosen to kill all the others. From there, according to Josephus, those final 10 cast lots to see who would be last, and so kill the other 9, and then himself. As a last act of defiance, as defined by Eleazar, the rebels didn't destroy the grain stores or taint the water supply. They wanted to show the Romans that they could have held out longer, that if they had continued to be besieged, they could have survived, and that they were choosing God's punishment and mercy rather than that of the incoming army. For a long time, the story of Masada was pretty lost, in part because Josephus, himself a Jew, was considered a traitor due to his relationship with the Roman elite, and his works didn't form the basis of much study among rabbis and other Jewish intellectuals. It's also not hard to understand that for a long time, the story was seen negatively, right? It was a tale of rebellion that ended up costing thousands of lives. The rabbis were not about to lift this story up as hopeful, as a model to follow. But in the early 20th century, amidst the growing Zionist movement and growing persecution of Jews around Eastern Europe, the poet Isaac Lamdin wrote a long work titled Masada. Himself an immigrant to Palestine from Russia, Lamdin brought the story back into popular consciousness. The poem does not valorize the murders and suicides, but rather valorizes the notion of a last stand. Over time, Lamdin's reintroduction led to an enlarging and elaboration. Suddenly, the siege had lasted much longer than Josephus describes, and the rebel forces had defended themselves vigorously. For many years, Israeli soldiers took an oath on the site, declaring, "Masada shall not fall again." The story had become a national symbol for not giving in. It was used as a rallying cry for rebellions and for taking a stand, especially in the wake of World War II. Though other stories of heroism have come to dominate, the Masada tale had its moment as a rallying cry for resistance. I was extremely affected by the story of Masada 8 years ago, and periodically it comes back into my mind. Certainly the pride that our guide seemed to feel as he related Josephus's account to a group of tourists did not resonate with me, that sense of pride. Certainly, I didn't hear the tale and think that it was brave and courageous for these rebels to take their own lives and the lives of their families. Standing there, aware that I was on a spot possibly occupied by a member of this rebel force from nearly 2,000 years ago, what I primarily felt was sadness. Tears pricked my eyes, and I was struck mostly by how strange it was that this story should be understood in such courageous and positive terms. Because to me, the story screams, here were a people forced into a horrible choice no one should have to make. Here is an example of how helplessness can overwhelm. Here is an example of how sometimes living just seems impossible. Here is a story of one way that people react when they feel abandoned, when they feel alone, when they feel powerless. To me, in the end, it seemed more a story about hopelessness than of bravery. And please don't misunderstand me. I don't think that my interpretation or experience of the story is any more or less accurate than any other. This is just how I felt about this story. History and stories are interpreted and reinterpreted over and over for personal agendas and for political ones. But for me, the story was so powerful and has had such sticking power exactly because it teaches me that hope is absolutely vital for resistance and resilience and action. As I have processed my reaction to this story over and over the years, it has also helped me to crystallize what hope is in the context of my beliefs and our shared tradition. For the rebels in the story, the ultimate hopelessness was when Eleazar told them that their God would not come to save them. And their solution was to remove themselves from this world and face their God in the next. They had hope in their God, not in saving them now, but in that after peace, that forgiveness and understanding was possible in death. And so what do hope and hopelessness look like if you're someone like me who doesn't believe in a God that acts in this world? Many of us are unlikely to ever face the terrible choice the rebels faced on Masada, but most of us do know what it means to hope for things and to have those hopes thwarted. We know what it is to lose faith in our fellow humans, to watch history unfold and wonder why justice seems so far away still. We know the power, most of us, that hopelessness can have. We know the capacity of anxiety to overwhelm. We know the distress that can accompany changes over which we don't feel we have control. We know how days and days of rain can make it feel like it will rain forever. We know what that ragged and pointed edge of hopelessness can feel like. So then what does hope look like and where does it come from? Some people say that hope is like a lie because life is so terrible, no matter what hope tries to sell you, it's awful. I cannot and will not believe that. It is antithetical to my theology, which maybe at the end is actually a theology of hope. God as a word for the human capacity to work for change, to envision something better, to overcome the overwhelm and continue to see the beauty and value in life even in difficult times. The writer Anne Lamott puts it this way: hope begins in the dark, the stubborn hope that if you just show up and try to do the right thing, the dawn will come. Hope is the belief that even the darkest feelings and even the worst moments are a temporary part of this life. Hope is the belief that things will be better in time because living, being, has value. And we humans are even more powerful than we realize because we do indeed have some measure of control, no matter if in the end that control is just over how we feel or how we see things. We can make things different by looking at them differently, by making changes, by participating in our own lives. We can look at lightning and see a terrifying force of fires beyond our control. Or we can look at lightning and see a powerful reminder of Earth's ability to replenish and renew itself and the sources of all life. Somewhere over time, I came across this anonymous quote about hope. It says, "Hope is putting faith to work when doubt would be easier." That link is really important. Hope and faith are intertwined, but faith doesn't have to be in God. It can be in oneself, in one's family, in one's community, in humanity as a whole. Hope is putting faith to work when doubt would be easier. Often when I describe Unitarian Universalism, the words hope and faith never actually cross my lips. They seem to carry too much for a lot of people. But I really do think that these things are as central to our movement as to any other, even if they look a bit different for us. I think they're what keep us coming back each Sunday and keep us doing the work of justice, of building and transforming ourselves. I believe that my time with you makes a difference. When I feel lost, it centers me to be here. It reminds me what I have faith in. I have faith in us, in our capacity to move the world. And I believe that my presence in the world and your presence in the world can help others. If we live our lives with hope and with joy, then perhaps that serves as a reminder to people in dark times that there can be light again. Hope isn't easy. It's hard work, putting up a sense of faith and hope against doubt and holding on. And I consider myself a realist, so I will just say, sometimes we do reach that point when it no longer makes sense to hope in vain for something that simply cannot be, because that hope prevents us from actually living fully. But more often than not, the hope is what helps us working towards the things we want to see in the world. And if given a choice between living a life with hope or with none, I would take a life with hope every time, even if it comes in strange places. And even if that choice of hope, becomes an act of rebellion in itself. For me, then, that was sort of the lesson of Masada, standing there on ground leveled 2,000 years ago in a fortress built onto a plateau that rises up out of the barren desert land like hope in the darkness, standing on reddish dirt in which you would think nothing can grow, but which has trees forcing themselves up and out of the earth. Among ruins that serve as proof that all things, however strong and however terrible, change with time. What I heard, the lesson I heard, was a reminder to never give up hope that life can get better, that we can make things better. I heard the reminder that we have an obligation to help each other embrace hope deeply, to care for each other when we are in our darkest moments. May we hold on to our hope, strengthened in our belief in the power of humanity to overcome and to create a better world. And may we be, for each other, reminders of the beauty and possibility of life. May the earth itself remind us of the reality of change and the opportunity that brings. And when times of challenge would overwhelm us, may we nurture and tend the glimmers of hope wherever we find them. So may it be.